We are. I'm Robert Field from Drexel University, and I'm going to talk a little bit more broadly about healthcare reform in general. My premise is healthcare regulation, which I define broadly to include funding programs as well as regulatory programs, is the crucible. Basically, it is what created our private healthcare system, and I'm going to talk about what that means for healthcare reform. I have no specific relationships to disclose other than I do believe that if health reform passes, I'll be living in a better country. So I will give that disclaimer. I want to talk broadly about what I mean by regulation, then talk about the conventional view, which is that it's an external force outside of the market that is sometimes necessary. It's kind of a necessary evil to constrain some of the market excesses, but it's not part of the engine that creates innovation and growth. Again, I'm going to talk quite broadly about regulation. It's a deliberate state influence, to quote two authorities, that includes command and control, telling entities, hospitals, doctors, drug companies what they can and can't do, adjudicating disputes, and funding. And the takeaway message that I'd like to present here is that the government can't take over healthcare because it already has. In fact, it not only took over healthcare 50 or 60 years ago, it has been running healthcare ever since then, and it invented the healthcare system we have now. So this is more or less the conventional view. You have a separation between regulators on one side, some of them are private organizations, Joint Commission and so forth, and then industry on the other. And an example of that is as a result of interference, keyword, at the federal and state level, healthcare is one of America's most heavily regulated industries. It's true, it is one of the most, if not the most heavily regulated. The muddled approach may act as a drag on the economy, costing us $169 billion a year. Probably that number would be more today. And then this analysis from the Cato Institute breaks that down. It's interesting that they look at the costs and the benefits of different kinds of regulation. The biggest cost is from the tort system, which actually isn't regulation. So their $169 billion is already, should be cut in half, is already kind of a false figure. And in terms of healthcare reform, now I admit I'm taking an extreme view here, but the libertarian approach is health care reform is needed, but a government takeover is not the answer. So I would say that they're about 6 or 7 decades too late on that one. So when we talk about regulation, government involvement, we're really talking about a public-private partnership. We're talking about regulators both in the industry and professions. State regulators, federal regulators, working together as a kind of collaborative. And if you don't mind my corny graphic, it's the foundation on which our healthcare system actually rests. So my proposed view is the dichotomy of separating them into two separate halves is false, that healthcare programs are all complex public-private collaborations. It's not one or the other. And that it's the public initiatives that actually created the private healthcare sector. Some examples, we've been regulating healthcare more and more over the years. There's no question about that. But it's hardly constrained the growth of this industry. We're up to 16% of GDP as of 2006. We're rapidly getting to 20% by 2015, if not before, while the percent of federal spending in the healthcare pot continues to go up. So as the federal side goes up, the overall industry goes up. Now maybe you could say that it shouldn't be going up that fast, but the fact is the extent that we have this huge healthcare sector, it's government involvement that's gotten us there. We see that as the percent of public spending on healthcare, direct public spending being about half of our healthcare spending in this country, the private spending in healthcare has gone up as well. So it's clearly not one or the other. It's both together. And this is just a quick graphic showing the way different programs have built on one another for the past 150 years or so. Again, no question we have a lot of healthcare regulation, but no question we have a huge, blossoming, innovative industry with a strong, strong private sector. and a strong employment engine, a figure that's often overlooked with 16% of GDP, is it's also almost an ongoing stimulus program. Almost 10% of all non-farm jobs in this country are in healthcare, and it is probably the only industry that's growing right now. So quickly, this is the theme of some research I have been doing to look at five sectors of healthcare and see the way the government really invented them as they are today. Hospitals, medical profession, particularly specialists and specialization, the pharmaceutical industry, private health insurance, and then managed care. And in terms of the hospital industry, Hill-Burton Act obviously was seminal in bringing it about as it is today. Think of the hospital industry prior to 1946 and what happened throughout the 50s and 60s and beyond. Over half of all hospitals in the U.S. have participated, and about 40% of all hospital beds in use today can trace their original funding to the Hill-Burton Act from 1946. It also helped to shape the industry with requirements for indigent care and for non-discrimination. So it was funding and it was shaping this industry today, which provides so much indigent care and emergency care and so on and so forth. Hospital construction has gone up markedly over the years. I would point out in constant 1972 dollars, you see it going up as a percent of total non-residential construction. It's had its ups and downs, but you see its two ups, early 50s, soon after Hill-Burton, it shot up from 10 to about 16%, and then in the early 70s, right after Medicare being passed, it shot up from about 12 to about 16% again. So you can see a direct relationship there. Hospital expenditures, again, I mean, and look at those numbers, going up by a factor of about 5. All the time that Medicare has been going up quite steadily. I don't have to reiterate this story. You look at the first fiscal year of Medicare Part A at $2.6 billion, 2007 at almost $300 billion just for Part A. Now, these are not inflation-adjusted numbers. Nevertheless, you can see Medicare is chugging along and will continue to do so while hospital construction is doing the same. The same point graphically in terms of seeing the slope of the increase. The tax exemption for hospitals, for nonprofit hospitals, which is still the preponderance of them, is worth about $6 billion in lost revenue on the federal side and about $6 billion in state and local revenue, property taxes being a big piece of that, coupled with regulatory requirements, again, for indigent care, emergency rooms, accepting Medicare and Medicaid, community outreach. So we once again have a huge federal spending program, $12 billion a year, at least that used to be considered a lot of money, coupled with regulatory programs that are shaping the industry as it is today. So I want to end this part of the talk, as I will with each of the discussions of each of the five sectors, which is to ask rhetorically, what would it look like if we hadn't had this federal involvement that created and pretty much invented it as today? And the answer in each is going to be pretty much the same. We've had hospitals for millennia. We still have them. But would it be as robust an industry, as innovative, as accessible as it is today? And I would say absolutely not. Particularly, we'd have fewer academic medical centers, fewer rural hospitals, fewer inner city hospitals, probably smaller hospitals with less technology, less employment, that engine that's driving 10% of our employment, and fewer ancillary providers. And just a final graphic here looks at the numbers of these kinds of institutional ancillary providers in response to Medicare programs that have funded them. We wouldn't have these industries, some of them at all, home health, portable x-rays, even hospices, if it weren't for Medicare's involvement. So let's look at the medical profession, and here I want to focus on specializations. We had licensure 100 years ago that sort of shaped the industry as it is today. We had the legal doctrine of a corporate practice of medicine, which is still in existence in most states, and it restricts the ability of for-profit corporations to directly employ doctors and has given a lot of legal clout and therefore economic clout to the medical profession. We manage the physician workforce with heavy subsidies in some cases, and we've got good old Medicare reimbursing and paying for training. So the growth of the medical profession, the number of doctors in this country has doubled to tripled over a 30-year period, ending just recently. The number of medical schools went up dramatically in response to federal funding, the number of physicians in the population, but look particularly at the number of specialists. So we've been growing the profession, particularly the specialty side. Obviously, the salaries have gone up. We know that story. Revenue for medical schools. We know that they get a lot of grants. Just one of the hidden ways that we're subsidizing them. Look at practice plans, right? That's clinical revenue for medical school faculty. That is heavily Medicare money, Medicare and some Medicaid money. And we see that funding well over a third of medical schools, in addition to the outright grants. Number of physicians going up, physicians in primary care coming down as we shape the industry towards specialists, residents and interns coming up in response to Medicare funding them, and then briefly Part B going from $0.8 billion in 1967 to $178 billion in 2007. So what would the profession look like if we didn't have these government programs that shaped it? Clearly more, I believe, more employed physicians because we wouldn't have the corporate practice of medicine, more in primary care, fewer specialists, and probably lower salaries. Okay. Quickly, in the interest of time, the pharmaceutical industry, I want to focus on NIH and the way NIH funds basic research without which the industry would not be able to do applied research which produces drugs. NIH budget doubled from the late 90s to about 3 or 4 years ago. Pharmaceutical industry private research went up right along with it. And these are pharma's, the industry's own figures, showing the way the industry's research budgets have gone up pretty much in parallel with NIH's. I would say that that's not a coincidence. Prescription drug sales going up by a factor of almost five from 1993. A number of blockbuster drugs, which is the industry's financial engine, drugs that bring in more than $1 billion a year in sales, going from six in 1998 to 51 in 2006. So what would the industry look like without NIH? Clearly fewer blockbusters, 47 of them are directly tied to NIH funding, less biotechnology and a lot less genomic developments because we wouldn't have had the Human Genome Project. Health insurance, I want to focus on the tax subsidy here, although ERISA and state regulations and the story of the World War II wage freeze have a lot to do with it. This is an estimate of what, we all know the tax subsidy for health insurance is worth about $250 billion a year right now, and it's going up steadily. As a percentage, it's over a third of the cost of all private premiums paid in this country are subsidized by the tax subsidy. So we're looking at a private industry that's at least one-third funded by federal and state governments. I would say that that's not really a private industry. We would probably still have health insurance even without all of this. We did in the 30s before the tax subsidy. However, there'd probably be a lot less employment-based insurance. It would cost more with less in the premium pot, probably less to reimburse providers. More people would probably go without insurance without the tax subsidy, and maybe we would have had universal coverage already because the private employment-based system wouldn't be what it was. And then finally, HMOs were directly created through the federal HMO Act in 1973. Growth in HMOs is obviously dramatic, both private and Medicare and Medicaid HMOs. That had a lot to do with the growth of that industry segment, is using them under Medicare and Medicaid. So would they still exist? Yeah, they would, because they predate, actually, the 1973 Federal HMO Act, but they'd be a minor part of the market. Would people have chosen them voluntarily? I wonder about that. But maybe we would have had different kinds of innovations in insurance coverage. Maybe it would have gone in different directions. It undoubtedly wouldn't have gone this way to this extent. My premise, summarizing all this, is that these regulatory programs fund and guide private activity. In most cases, they don't directly direct them. They just create the infrastructure and the funding that allows the private sector to carry the ball. In terms of healthcare reform, again, government can't take over healthcare, as I've tried to show in these five key industry segments. It did decades ago. And that these programs don't eliminate the private sector, they actually facilitate it, they actually enable it, that they are actually essential to creating the private sector role in our healthcare system, that this is where further evolution of the system will come from, that comprehensive reform requires a vigorous government element, but that it also involves a vigorous private element, that the result will be an expansion of private market opportunities. Whatever program is passed, there will be winners and losers. It may not be the same constellation that it is today, but that it will ultimately strengthen and not preempt the private market, so that we are really talking about a plan that will be a private sector, private public collaboration, as it has in the past. Thanks.
Hi, we have some time for questions. I'm going to pass the microphone to the speakers, and would anybody like to ask a question? Yes?
Question for Dr. Ventures. I'm a big fan of your work, and I just wanted to see if you could give us an update on what you perceive has happened since the short tenure of Dr. Shiro, who got brought into ICE, particularly the quality assurance, quality control in the county correctional facilities and local correctional facilities that detainees are being taken. They don't have public health service officers. What's being done to ensure that, that care is being delivered consistently and appropriately?
Sure, that's a great question. So to set the context, Dora Shiro, who had run the Arizona State Department of Corrections with Secretary Napolitano, came over to ICE, to Homeland Security, was there and actually was just stolen away to Rikers, Miami, which is a big plus for Rikers. But in her very short tenure there, she traveled all over the country. She was kind of put in charge of looking at how to reform detention. So she traveled for 4 or 5 months, met with every advocacy group, everybody that wanted to talk, and she came up with a couple of fundamental suggestions for how to improve detention. One is to limit the restrictiveness of the detention setting to the basically like the threat or the security concerns. So for most migrant workers who are detained, they don't need to be in if they need to be detained at all, they certainly don't need to be in these like maximum or medium security facilities. But the question you raise about the fact that two-thirds of immigrants are detained in these county jails, local lockups, those are places where the Division of Immigrant Health Services, which is a part of Homeland Security, which is, you know, they have this long, very storied tradition of providing high-level medical care to immigrants through the Public Health Service. Those folks only staff about the facilities work that ICE runs. So in two-thirds of the cases, immigrants are in local jails. I have advocated with Dora, and I guess we'll continue to advocate that DIHS expand its coverage, and so that we can take this cadre of experts in this area and get them to at least surveil and monitor health standards in all these county jails. That's that right now is up in the air. So we're pushing very hard for either an expansion of DIHS or ICE to bring in new medical professionals that can kind of replicate that role for all these county jails.
I have a question about the patient-tailored medicine. At the health center I'm at, and one of the problems that we run into is how do you prevent the more we know about the genetics, like I'm taking an example like BRCA1, BRCA2 testing, but that data is not being, that information is not being used for developing pharmaceuticals, but it's being, those screening tests are being used for embryo screening, you know, and behind it, but also the ethical
underpinning that goes along with that. And I think this is an area, like many, where science and medicine, frankly, is outstripping law. And so there aren't any really clear answers. And so I would say we have to fall back on most of the notions of patient rights and patient autonomy.
Yes. One part of the position point of your 5 points and government's interventions that have created the growth of the current status of the market, I assume, first of all, would also include legislation regarding international medical practice. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if when you showed what we would look like for a government not involved in that physician component. We have fewer specialists and probably lower salaries, et cetera. Would you, given that those are many of the problems, if you will, that we are now trying to confront in this country, would you suggest that government did harm, or that is there a way that government can now flip the process to redirect all of those results?
The fact that the government created these private sectors doesn't mean it always did the right thing. I would say place-based insurance, for instance, you could argue has not been for the best, and the rising number of medical specialists has not been for the best. What I would say is that if there were no involvement, though, those sectors as a whole would be nowhere near as vital and vibrant as they are. So that would be a way to switch policy, and I would say that if there isn't a public policy towards that, it is not going to happen.
Yes.
Following up on the BRCA point, I think there is sort of a legal issue, which is that BRCA is owned by Myriad Genetics, which has privatized, you know, the gene and the pharmacogenomics that you're describing are going to be very much in the control of the pharmaceutical industry. There is a human rights issue here, which is something in some sense of the panel, and it's to have our genetics under our own control rather than under corporate controls. And two, probably to just worry a lot about science and technology. You can't put genes back in bottles in this situation. But then on the other hand, we can be very worried. We can know that Tuskegee will happen again. We know that it happened in Philadelphia. Just around the corner, many, many years later. And we should be very, very, very careful about advancing technology, which doesn't clearly advance our health, particularly when it's enormously expensive and has limited utility.
Yes?
I actually have a question for Dr. regarding the mental health, human rights. There is a cultural aspect to this. How well does the law protect the culture where there is a certain beliefs that really are essential components of this one?
That's a very important point as well. One of the challenges, I think, when you're thinking about a universal human rights standard, and this is one of the most contentious perpetual debates in human rights, is universalism versus cultural relativism, and how much sway do you have, how much flexibility do you have when you're trying to come up with these kinds of standards? And I think that, at least with regard to looking at a right to mental health, I think there are a large number of areas where I think there can be a consensus reached. There will be some areas where there might be, especially in, well, I think there are two areas where there's going to be a discrepancy around the world. You know, one area would be based not on cultural differences, but on economic differences. And all the human rights treaties that talk about the right to health also talk about progressive realization. So countries have to move towards fulfilling and protecting and respecting the right to health, but they're not expected to be there overnight, and there's a recognition that some countries have greater resources to achieve that more rapidly than others, but that all countries are required to move in that direction. Second thing, back to the cultural differences, I think that there is room for some variation to respect cultural practices, but if the cultural practices are perpetuating negative stereotypes, are perpetuating exclusion, then I think they have to be challenged in some cases. So I think it's you know, there are different scenarios where that flexibility can be completely consistent with protecting human rights, but there are some other situations where it might be in significant tension. So I think it's not an easy question to answer, but it's an important concern to keep in mind.
Thank you. That's all the time we have. Please join me.